Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the war on smoking, abortion rights after Roe, and we answer your questions in our new postbag section. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am in every episode, by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here in the heart of swinging London. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well.
How's the family? All right?
Yeah, not too bad. You've been on holiday recently, haven't
you? Yeah, went to Sicily.
Nice.
Yeah, nice and brown, aren't I?
You look gorgeous.
Thank
Listeners
you.
Can't see, Cheers. But he's got a wonderful northern tan at the moment. So we're also delighted to be joined by returning guest on the show, longtime friend of the podcast, Claire Fox, unaffiliated peer in the House of Lords and director of the Academy of Ideas. Claire, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Great to be here. I have not been to Sicily on holidays, which I really wish I had.
I know that was more small talk than we normally have, so that was Chris's fault for derailing it. But let's go back to what we're here to talk about. The first topic, Chris, is smoking. So in the past month, you've been writing about, and we've been writing about on Spike, the Kahn Review, Making Smoking Obsolete, which is a pretty bold title. So the mask has slipped for the prohibitionists, if they were ever wearing it to begin with. Do you want to talk about some of the proposals in this? Because they're pretty...
Pretty wild. I wrote an article for Spiked, I think last year, about Action on Smoking Health. That's ASH for short. ASH's plan. They've got a sort of puppet old party group, and this old party group published a report saying we should do these 12 things. And pretty much all of them are in this Kahn review, plus others. You know, it is really extreme stuff. Firstly, why is this guy doing a review in tobacco control? Okay, who is he? He's the chair or maybe former chair of Barnardo's, so a big charity that doesn't look after any orphans. So he's just part of the third sector revolving door. I never said anything about tobacco, as far as I'm aware. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it can be a good thing to get a fresh pair of eyes on the job. But it's just another example of governments sort of trying to take the politics out of issues. You know, we're not going to make any decisions. We're not going to come up with any policies ourselves. We'll get this random person to do it. Did the same thing with Henry Dimbleby with food. You know, why can't governments, why can't politicians come up with policies? They're called politicians. It's derived from the same blooming word, I think.
Indeed.
You know, come up with policies, lay them before the electorate, and we can vote on them, you know. But they don't. They get these, elite figures to do it for them. And, of course, what really happens is immediately, as soon as the pressure groups find out that this bloke's going to be doing a review, they inundate him with various proposals, reports, lobby him, and immediately these people go native. Exactly the same thing happened with Henry Dimbleby. And it is parrot their policies. Now, with the policies themselves, they include things like banning any TV or any TV program or film that shows anyone using tobacco before 9 p.m. In the evening. And if they do show tobacco, even after 9 p.m., it's got to come up with some health warning. Painting cigarettes green and brown, that was one.
Explain this to me. What is
I don't
is this
know.
Supposed to put people there, off?
It's only a few years since they banned Sobriety cocktails. You know what Sobriety cocktails are? Claire will.
Yes.
I don't. I smoked for a long time. I never saw a pack of Sobriety cocktails. They were quite popular, I think, in the 60s. Maybe the 70s, just but they're all different colours. That was the thing, right?
They were kind of pretty.
Got you.
They were meant to be kind of classy, but I mean, in a kind of naff way.
Yeah.
But you'd kind of like.
They were multicoloured.
But anyway, I mean, I never saw anyone smoke them, but you'd get them at sort of special do's where people would say, oh, I want
to. And they came to the fore during the plain packaging campaign when the anti smoking campaigners were trying to look for the sexiest packs that they could do. They go, like, these are the kind of things we're going to ban. Because obviously, loads of kids are buying Sobriety cocktail for £30 a pack. But now they're basically bringing them back because they're going to paint the cigarettes green and brown. Well, firstly, a brown cigarette just looks like a small cigar, doesn't it? I mean, that's not unattractive. I don't even think a green cigarette would be that unattractive. I can't think of any colour you could put a cigarette in, it wouldn't look quite cool.
But the truth is, I personally do not smoke cigarettes on the basis of their aesthetic look. Mm. I mean, I like smoking. So the idea, this is all of these things like, oh, you only smoke because of the type of packaging that we used to have. Do you know what I mean? You kind of like were attracted by the design features and now they're all plain packaging. Has that put you off? No, it's annoyed an awful lot of people who work in shops who can't find what they're looking for. But apart from that, we've all got used to it. People steal your cigarettes more readily because, they can go, these are mine.
And no, do
you
they?
Can't immediately. No, you put a packet down. And people, I don't mean they consciously, but I mean, people pick up each other's buckets because you basically pick it up. And then it's only when you get home, you find out you've got Benson and Edges rather than your preferred brand or what have you. But it's not put anyone off smoking, the point I'm making. Yeah, so the idea that you will have a different coloured cigarette and that this will kind of, you go, I can't be seen with a green cigarette. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a dirty habit, to be honest. And that's what I'm saying is I don't want to be seen with it. I want to smoke it. And that's why it's ridiculous.
Putting paint on it probably makes them less healthy as well, I would think. You're sticking a whole load of chemicals that you're going to end up smoking.
This is all.
But they don't care about that. I don't care about smokers. And this is really the point. You know, the one group of people who are not stakeholders in this conversation are smokers. Smokers now are explicitly there to be beaten and oppressed and squeezed until there's no more than 5% of them, which is the government target for 2030.
Is that what smoke-free means, 5%?
That's what, they call that tobacco-free. I don't know. I mean, that means we're kind of heroin-free as well, I guess, as a country, which is quite encouraging.
Small wins.
And, you know, I mean, this guy had the opportunity to make a positive case for this target. I obviously don't think there should be a target anyway, and I don't think it's really achievable. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to make a positive case, you would say, well, we've got lots of, you know, vapes and nicotine pouches and heated tobacco and all sorts of alternatives to cigarettes. Let's try and encourage smokers to switch to them. And, you know, conceivably within 8 years, you actually could come somewhere close to that target. But he hasn't done that. He's taken the old, you know, let's use the stick approach.
Yeah. And sorry if you mentioned it there, Chris, but this is raising the legal age slowly, year by year.
I didn't mention it. Yeah, that's another of his ideas. And initially it was leaked that he was going to suggest raising the smoking age to 21. But actually he is saying we should raise it every year indefinitely. So people
eventually be 65.
So people who are, you'll end up with, 60-year-olds asking 61-year-olds outside shops to buy a pack of cigarettes. So we just go up. And so people who are children now will essentially just be frozen forever as being your children.
Claire, what do you make of this? Especially the kind of infantilizing aspects of this, I guess.
I mean, I think there's a number of things. I think you're absolutely right, Chris, to indicate that this is completely anti-democratic in the sense that it's the outsourcing of report writing to the great and the good so that the government don't appear to have their fingers all over it. And then they can say, oh, well, the evidence shows. And the evidence is just, we've asked a man or a woman who had a job once in a kind of respected position to write a report up. You know what I mean? And so then everybody then starts referring to the Kahn review or whatever, as though it's a thing, right? And that becomes the evidence. Whereas actually, it's not the evidence. Yeah. It's just somebody's compiled all the worst ideas about smoking into one place. Yeah. But it gives it a certain authority. The other thing is that to me, it's just preposterous that they're even declaring a smoke-free, you know, future, as it were, because they should just simply say, we're going to ban cigarettes. I've always said this. And in fact, I made a point that they were absolutely furious. I said, yeah, well, fine. Have the courage of your conviction. Argue to make smoking illegal, right?
But that
is a fight, as it were, that one can have. Yeah. I don't want them to do it, of course. I'm just making the point that it irritates me that it's never quite explicit.
It's been disingenuous the whole time.
Totally disingenuous. That's what they want to do, but they kind of barely can say it. But as you say, they're getting bolder. And that's the way that we're going to end up. And very few people want to be seen to be defending smokers because they have got away with, and I think we saw this long before the kind of COVID demonization of types of people question, they got away with demonizing smokers, didn't they? I mean, that was always a type who you could basically treat with contempt. Mm. I always remember those things where people started to say things like, you're smelly and you think, God almighty.
There was an NHS
Similarity
TV.
Is completely disappeared.
There was an NHS TV advert around about 2005 that just ended with the slogan flashed up on the screen, if you smoke, you stink.
I remember that.
No, but I get a lot of trolling on social media, which I'm not complaining about because, you know, I'd be the type, right? But but you can't, you know, say things like I say things and then expect everyone to go, oh, how wonderful you are. So I'm not moaning about it, but I've been shocked at how personal it is, dare I say. And part of the personal attack, the ones who are really vicious and vile, particularly about what you look like and everything, link it every time to smoking. Mm. So they're like this dirty, ash-ridden hag. I mean, that's what... No, that's mild. That's mild. That is mild. You know, who undoubtedly stinks like an ash... You know, you think, God. So they link their abuse to smoking. That's kind of become acceptable. That somehow makes it all right. So, and I think that that does make it difficult to have the kind of democratic argument, because they've got away with making guilt by association, that even if you don't smoke and you believe in freedom, that people are a bit like, oh yeah, but, oh yeah, yeah. But. The final thing is you said about the infantilization. I mean, the age limit thing. I mean, I couldn't believe it when I realised what they were saying about that. You know, that it could be, it goes up and up and up. But the original idea, we're all fed up of hearing how brilliant children are. I mean, you know what I mean? And 16-year-olds are most enlightened. Mm-hmm. They should have the vote. They're far more trustworthy on everything than any grown-up. You've got all these backward ideas. They should be, you know, invited into Parliament to run society. We must be beholden to their great insights and their social justice instincts. But they shouldn't be able ever to smoke. I mean, that is effectively, I mean, you know, they can't be trusted to buy a packet of cigarettes at 18. You know what I mean? So it the whole...
Or ever.
And then you discover or ever. But that's partly what it's about, because I've noticed, because there's so few people who smoke, that a lot of these... the justification for these changes, and this actually happens with gambling as well, is even if it's not for people now, it's for future generations. And this is a particularly irritating, anti-democratic argument. It comes up with climate change all the time. You're not doing it for you. You're not doing it for your kids. You're not doing it for your grandchildren. You're doing it for future generations as yet unborn, so that there's a smoke-free, they won't ever
build a good, clean country.
Well, guess what? They can't, but they also can't answer back, can they? Do you know what I mean? I mean, who do we know? What I mean, we're basically acting on behalf of generations into the future that haven't got a say in all this. And that's a way that you can kind of never be held to account by a group of people who might say, as you said, the stakeholders who are smokers, well, these lot aren't even born yet. So I mean, anyway, it just annoys me.
Of course. I mean, it was interesting to see Chris Whitty declare that it was utterly disingenuous to say that this was an argument between health and freedom, just that being completely dismissed. And smoking is, again, it's something which has become increasingly unpopular, as you say, Claire, but in terms of a case study of how civil liberties get kind of salami sliced away, or the slippery slope, or whatever metaphor you want to reach for. You know, first of all, it was 16, then it was put up to 18. Then you can't smoke indoors. Now they're talking about banning smoking outside pubs. You know, you even get kind of sections of, they do this in Wetherspoons, I never really understand it, where there's this thin strip now
even outdoors,
in the beer garden where you're allowed to occupy, and on and on it goes. But Chris,
these are restrictions on freedom. The real restriction on freedom is tobacco industry selling cigarettes to people. Yeah, I mean, talk about who's being disingenuous there.
As you're both talking about there, the disingenuousness, because the ultimate goal was always towards effectively prohibition, whether it's now or, you know, several years hence. Chris, do you think they're actually going to get closer to that with this kind of review? Is it so ridiculous that it's just going to kind of, you know, lie on the back burner because it's... It has seemed to have generated a bit more of a response, this one, it seems like.
A bit more, yeah, a bit more. Because people went along with things like the smoking ban, because a lot of people just don't like the smell of smoke, simple as that. They don't care about things like plain packaging, display bans, tobacco taxes, because it doesn't affect them. And this stuff, to be fair, doesn't really affect them. But I think a decent proportion of the population, possibly a majority, still has a more or less a live and let live attitude, I would like to think. But the fact that the smokers are a minority and a dwindling minority is always going to be a big political problem. They haven't got any political voice. They tend to be disproportionately, quite heavily disproportionately, in the lowest socioeconomic groups. They've never stood up for themselves. You know, Claire knows about all this. You know, I do go to events with Forest, the freedom organisation for the right to enjoy smoking tobacco. And, you know, Simon Clark's always complaining that, you know, smokers just don't, unlike vapors, interestingly, but smokers just don't stand up for themselves. A lot of them are self-hating. About half of them would like to quit, in theory, you know. So, yeah, they're a marginalised group who don't really even identify themselves as being a political group, you know. So it's very difficult to stand up against this, and it's very easy for politicians who just want a cheap headline to go along with it.
Sorry, Claire.
A couple of things to pick up. I think that these are such ludicrous measures that... There has been some reaction, but I also think that a greater number of people are conscious about the liberty versus safety or public health issue post the pandemic. And I don't, you know, I mean, even in the kind of mainstream minority, you know what I mean? People just recognizing that there's this trade-off that you're asked to do all the time. And I think that's made people a bit more sensitive. So when I made a couple of, you know, jibes on the smoking issue in the House of Lords, I was quite surprised how many people said, well, I'm not a smoker, but on this one, I feel like opening a packet of cigarettes. You know, there's a bit of that going on, which I hadn't noticed very much in previous years. I did also want to note the anti-working class paternalism of this, because whenever it comes up, I mean, this is, again, this is shared with the gambling stuff, which is that when people talk about this, they say it really is explicitly we're saving them from themselves. And I was horrified at some discussion on social housing that then started to say we've got to discourage people from smoking in their houses, and that's going to be part of some contracts of social housing, you know, tenancies and so on. I mean,
all of them have come.
Carl wants that all the way through. You think, God almighty, the housing crisis, right? There's not enough social housing being built anyway, in my opinion. And then the people who are in them are now going to be punitively dealt with. You know, it's a bit like what they did to prisoners and so on and so forth. But the point that you've also made, Chris, which is no positive vision at all. You know what I mean? It's like at least, I was actually thinking, at least in prison, they kind of gave everyone free vapes. You know what I mean? They kind of went around. They knew there might be riots otherwise, right? Yeah. So they banned. I thought it was still inhumane that they did it, but they did go around and give everyone. And one of the first things you get when you go into prison, apparently, is a vape. Yeah. And they kind of keep you supplied. You know what I mean? Like it's like, because they know. But if you're a social housing tenant, no such bloody luck, right? You're just not allowed to smoke. It's the one place that you should be free to even do this rather dirty habit, because I don't want to ever make a virtue out of smoking. I hate the fact that I've been forced into a position where it's something I have to discuss, but it's because the state won't leave us alone.
Another area where the state doesn't want to leave us alone, Chris, increasingly seems to be gambling, which is something which, I know it felt like it was kind of unfinished business for the nanny state set for a long while, but it's come back in a big way. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's being talked about, what's being proposed?
Yeah, I mean, very quick capsule history is that gambling is always a bit taboo with more people than I imagine, actually. I always think that people are pretty laid back about gambling, but every time it rears its head, you get people getting very excited about it. So you had the panic about the super casinos way back when with the Gambling Act of 2005. That never came to pass. Gordon Brown got rid of the proposal for having a super casino in Blackpool or Manchester. And then you had the panic a few years later about fixed odds betting terminals. That was finally resolved in 2018. They're essentially banned now to all intents and purposes. But that particular campaign created quite a strong coalition of groups, quite a weird coalition of groups, like including elements of the gambling industry, like who didn't like bookies or didn't like online, along with like the Salvation Army and the various bishops, Church of England and so on. And yeah, problem gambling charities as well. Maybe various people. And they were never going to stop with the fixed odds betting terminals. So they've been campaigning particularly against online gambling and also gambling advertising. And the government decided to do a review about 18 months ago, or put out a consultation 18 months ago. Didn't put any policies forward, just said, you know, give us your thoughts. What should we do? Do we need to update gambling regulation? And then the anti-gambling people were straight in there saying we should have a limit on how much people can spend every month gambling, like £40-50 we should do people. We want to ban gambling sponsorship. Obviously, there's a lot of that in football, but also massive amount in darts, snooker, my particular passion, rugby, all sorts of sports would be really badly disadvantaged by that going. Getting rid of gambling advertising, which was only legalized in 2005. They want to get rid of it again. And various things with gambling websites, like basically making them slower and less appealing and reducing the stakes and trying to deter people using them, really. So we're recording this on Wednesday, and according to the Times, the government is going to do roughly half of what the campaigners have been asking for. They're going to bring in stake limits online. I'm not quite sure what that price is going to be. They're going to bring in some form of what they call unobtrusive affordability checks. I don't know how that will work. And they're going to ban things like free bets and VIP deals, but they're not apparently going to bring in the sponsorship ban. They're not going to bring in a mandatory levy on industry. And they're certainly not going to bring in this deposit limit, which was a pretty crazy idea in the first place.
Claire, what do you make of all of this?
Well, I wanted to just report to you how I think this might work, that these ideas eventually become so influential. Because since I've been in the Lords, one of the issues that has really struck me as being ever present is anti-gambling questions. They hate it as a group. and they're quite well organised. It's like, I mean, you know, I get fed up of gambling ads on TV, but there's just as much as you kind of every time you turn on the TV, there's a gambling ad. Every time you walk in the House of Lords, there's an anti-gambling question, you know what I mean, to a minister. And they kind of chip away, right? And there's a constant sort of chipping away. And the ministerial teams all look rather sort of like, oh, God, here we go again. But because there's so many of them, it gives the impression all the time that gambling is this massive social problem. And, you know, you can be having a conversation about the cost of living crisis, and they'll say, and do you realise that the cost of living crisis will lead to even more problems of problem gambling and people are going to get into more debt? I mean, I don't matter what you're talking about.
Why are they so obsessed with it?
Well,
I've sort of seen, since you've been in the house, I've watched some of your bits for sure, obviously very good. And then I end up watching some of the other people who are awful. I mean, worse than the MPs. Really patrician and patronising and sneering about smoking and gambling in particular.
Patrician, patronising and sneering is a good description of the broad atmosphere. But I think that they, the great and the good are in there, a lot of them, but they've also got time. And if you're an MP, first of all, you're answerable to someone, right? And occasionally some of them might be gamblers. Whereas the House of Lords aren't. But you can kind of have a hobby horse, right? And they're quite well organised. And there's more time for them to kind of nag ministers, do you know what I mean, to no consequence. But I can see them creating a mood around this. And I really picked up on it because it's not that I kind of spend a lot of time thinking about the gambling issue. I've never gambled. I'm not a gambling type. And I've also seen some pretty nasty consequences of people getting into trouble for online gambling, right? So I'm not like entirely immune from saying there's bits of this I don't like much. But basically, it is a free society, and you should be able to gamble your money. And whereas they basically made out that it is the worst kind of corruption of the soul. They always link it to suicide, and it just chips away. Because if you keep saying suicide, young people, misery, and then there's this patrician, everybody's pro-working class in the House of Lords. You've got to understand. I mean, this is the most pro-working class place in the world. Because they want to save them. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, everybody loves the ordinary workers and they kind of need looking after by us. I mean, that's the mentality. And gambling has historically been one of those Puritan issues where those who kind of know best will save you from your sins and your weaknesses. And just on affordability tests, why I really object to affordability tests on gambling, even if they're unobtrusive, is the idea that the state or anyone else actually can go around saying, we're going to check on your whether you can really afford this. Just think of what it means. I mean, I actually spend money on things I can't afford all the time. Do you know what I mean? It has been known that I have gone out and bought things that really, strictly speaking, my bank account doesn't allow me to do. I've gone on holidays. I've gone for meals. I don't get expenses.
Do you not get expenses?
No, not in that way. You can't claim expenses in that way, but that to one side. But that's what I'm saying. You genuinely spend a lot of your life making decisions and assessments about whether you're going to do something reckless, like buy a dress you can't afford, or, you know, and the idea that somebody's going to stand there and go, oh, are you sure you can afford this? Right. Claire Fox, you absolutely certain. I mean, I've got that in my conscience, right? I don't need somebody physically standing in front of me. So I think the precedent being set of affordability tests is very dangerous because effectively what they're saying is we don't trust you to spend your own money sensibly, and we are going to intervene at key points to make sure that you are competent as adults to make these decisions.
But there's no other market where this applies, right? There's no other market where the person selling you the product is required to make sure that you can afford it. You can go and buy a Ferrari or something. You know, I've got an app where I can buy shares, and I can and do buy £5,000 worth of shares just like that, right? Just press the button. Now I have to have the money, obviously, but that's the same with online gambling. You have to actually have the cash in your bank account. And I don't want anybody asking me if I can afford it particularly. And lots of people, you know, talking about suicide, lots of people kill themselves because they lose money on the stock exchange. Probably all people have killed themselves from that and getting into bad business deals and have done with online gambling. So, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm carrying water for the gambling industry, but it seems a bit unfair to me that they're expected to know whether somebody gambling online, who they've never met, can afford this or not. And actually, they do a lot of these affordability checks. They do ring people up. They do close people's accounts down and suspend them and all this kind of stuff.
We can do also like present your scanning your pay slips for bet365 or something. Like, how would this
Exactly. So what's an unobtrusive affordability check? Either you can prove that you can afford it, which you'd have to basically do a kind of mortgage application kind of thing with. Yeah, here's my bank account. This is what I earn. Here's a letter from my employer saying that I work here and this is what I get. Or it's meaningless, right? Mm.
But it's also the case that there's a very small percentage of problem gamblers. We all recognise that. But like with all of these things, whether it's alcohol, whether it's smoking, well, alcohol particularly, where you can say, yes, there are alcoholics. So therefore we treat everybody like potential alcoholics. And that's what the gambling thing is. Like a very small percentage of gamblers get into really serious problems. But all people who gamble on in any variety are treated as though they're potentially on the brink of being a problem gambler.
And it is a really small percentage compared to alcoholism.
That is, actually, it is
0.2%.
Well, yeah, I mean, even if you take the worst case figures, they can't make it. It only goes to 0.7%, and that's if they really exaggerate it. So even they can't make it any more. But then on the affordability point, in the Lords debate on this, they actually used this example of a HSB report that said, oh, well, it's only 0.7%, but it's much worse than that because HSBC have written a report and they've looked at what people are spending on gambling and they say lots of people are spending far more on gambling than they should. This is a bank. You think what? So the bank is basically going around. Oh, the HSB funded. But, you know, it's like making a decision more than you should. Who's made that decision? Mm. And you might decide that you want to gamble one week in preference to, I don't know, buying the dress that I was going to squander my money on, right? So these are the kind of choices that we as adults, I just want to stress.
Banks
that we live in a free society. And therefore, will they please stop this? Because it's driving us all mad. And I do think that it chips away at the sense of people feeling that they are being trusted to make decisions of their own when you have people discussing whether we can be trusted with what we can afford to pay by at any given time.
The banks would never risk large amounts of money, obviously.
Never gamble, pound in their lives. We should move on and talk about Roe v. Wade and the demise of Roe v. Wade, really. It's hard to overstate, I guess, what a big moment the past week or so has been in relation to the question of civil liberties in America, the world over, insofar as it's kind of been this, it's become this big culture war kind of issue the world over, as well as being a more clear-cut civil liberties issue in America. Of course, the 50-year-old ruling effectively creating a kind of constitutional right to abortion in America being struck down, this leading to scores of US states with these trigger laws essentially making abortion illegal overnight, many more talking about placing more and more restrictions on it. Obviously a huge backlash from a lot of progressive campaigners and a lot of crying from the pro-life set who have been building up to this, I think it's fair to say, for decades, really, very through the legal system and activism and all the rest of it. But Claire, I think when this happened, a lot of people almost didn't believe it, despite the fact that the ruling was leaked not too long ago, the draft opinion by Justice Alito. It still seemed to have that kind of huge kind of body blow impact on a lot of people. What was your response to this?
Of course, I understand that because the impact on a lot of women's lives in America is going to be pretty shocking. And I think one of the problems is that it's easy to have taken abortion rights for granted. And indeed, one of the reasons why I never became a constitutional right in America was because a variety of presidents, you know, apparently those who are on the side of women's reproductive rights, didn't want to interfere and make it a constitutional right because they really didn't want to upset the apple cart. In other words, it was kind of, if we don't talk about it, we'll keep it forever. And that as a consequence, they never won the arguments for it. What do I think about it? I understand the democratic dilemma. I mean, you know, I do get the fact that states can make these decisions, but it's also the case that women need to have control over the reproductive lives and their bodies in order to be able to enact their equality and through that and their rights. Just in terms of being a culture war issue, I mean, I'm very wary of the way that it can become a bit like the killing of George Floyd, which is that, you know, people are hysterical in the UK about something that's very particular to America. I've noticed that people who had never really issued any kind of a statement on abortion and kind of like, whose side are you on? So you kind of even lose a sense of what abortion is with people kind of seeing it as kind of, you're either on the side of the you know, the woke feminazis or the kind of the good people who are interested in protecting children's rights and so on, which is obviously ridiculous because I'm not on the side of the woke, but I am on the side of women's equality, and therefore it's unhelpful to try and fit us all into these categories. So what do I hope we will get in the UK is I hope we'll be brave enough and courageous enough to have an argument in open with each other about abortion rights so that we all remember what the arguments are all about. Don't shy away from that. But not that we kind of develop a hysteria about the fact that the alt-right Nazis are coming along to steal women's rights, which is the way it's being posed at the moment. Trump deemed a fascist for having facilitated this, the return of women being chained to kitchen sinks. All rights will be smashed. Handmaid's Tale and gay marriage is going to end next week. I mean, you know, it's like over the top and unhelpful.
And Chris, there was one viral tweet last week from someone, I forget
Richard
his name.
Murphy.
Richard Murphy, the tax expert.
The godfather of Corbynomics, no less.
Who, again, made this point, as Claire was gesturing to there, that, you know, we're going to go down this slippery slope very soon, that this is what Johnson's Tories want to do.
It's insane stuff. And Dominic Samrit wrote a very good article for Unheard, trying to explain to people once again that Britain is not America. It's not even slightly similar to America. We just have the same language, you know, and like some of the same films and music. The number of people who want to ban abortion in this country, I can't remember what exact figure is, it's unbelievably small. It's like 3% or something like that, right? This is not a culture war issue even in this country, you know? America's a very different place. One of the things that's very different about it is the judges have way too much power. It's a messed up system where people are voting for a party on the basis of who they think they will appoint to the Supreme Court, right? And people, you know, abortion is a genuinely divisive issue in America. And because the courts, essentially the Supreme Court, essentially took the decision, people have stopped making the argument. Like Claire says, they've stopped making the argument for abortion because it's beyond democratic decision-making. But then, of course, that leaves you wide open to the Supreme Court changing. And every president has tried to, you know, had their fingers crossed that a couple of members of the Supreme Court are going to die so they can put their people in. And Donald Trump did it. And this is what you get. So, you know, if you're going to have constitutions and laws made by unelected judges, then you're bound to face this kind of situation.
No, exactly. And also you just get a sense that not only, I don't want to say the pro-choice movement specifically, but the kind of what considers itself to be the left of America feels so fantastically ill-equipped for this fight at this point, not least because they've relied on this judicial activism for so long to protect the gains, as you were saying, Claire, that they were worried might disappear from between their fingers. But also, they're just really unaccustomed to making these arguments. It's become subsumed into a kind of women are these, again, kind of dystopian-style victims rather than making the arguments for autonomy. There was an interesting thing a few years ago in the New York Times about how Generation Z were really uninterested in this particular question, even though there's been big battleground states to state and all the rest of it, because they wanted to talk about climate and they wanted to talk about Black Lives Matter and all this kind of stuff. The victimhood thing is all that they can really cling on to, and what you've got to have an argument here is about freedom and autonomy. But I know you haven't got much time, Claire. I think we've got to make some time here for the new section, the postbag section, complete with its own jingle.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, right?
So I'm going to start off here. This is one primarily for Chris here, although I'm sure Claire will have some thoughts on it. So this is from Robert Sankey. Chris, you often talk about the horrors of nanny state policies introduced in order to fix the obesity levels in the UK. While I agree with you that the government should not interfere in our lives, you really speak about the better, more liberal ways of solving this crisis. So what would be the liberal way to get the country to be healthier?
Every interview I ever do about obesity, eventually the interviewer will say, what would you do then? I don't care about obesity. I don't care how many people are fat. I don't. Why should it? The government shouldn't care. It's none of anyone else's business. I'm very old-fashioned, but, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, we were told it didn't matter what size, shape, colour or anything you were. You know, I don't, honestly don't care. If people want to, you know, lose weight, great. You know, maybe the government should give some advice on how to do that. It seems relatively straightforward to me, just eat less and exercise more. But I'm not bothered whether the obesity rate is 5% or 50%. Really doesn't have much effect on me. It doesn't have any effect on me. So I don't care. But also, I honestly don't have any policies to put forward. I've never come across a single policy that has had any evidence it's going to work or even sounds in theory like it's going to work. So I think leaving it up to individuals, and if, you know, I'm planning on getting fatter later in life. I'm just going to get fatter and fatter with a beer belly, and it'll be worth it because I like drinking beer. I don't care. It's really not my problem. It might be the problem that people have to look at me, but I'm not, you know, I don't care.
Does the harm principle kick in then? I don't know.
Oh, only very marginally, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose so. What about you, Claire? What do you think about this question of, you know, what's a liberal way out of these kinds of nanny state obesity questions?
Well, the thing is, we've just lost all sense of proportion. Like all of, and we just talked about problem drinkers or problem gamblers. There are some people for whom obesity is a problem, but that's kind of morbid. People. Yeah, no, but morbid obesity, where you're really talking people whose health is endangered by it. But we've lost a sense of what that is, and then made anyone who's a bit overweight, or as you say, wants to indulge and wants to and doesn't care what they look like. We've merged all of this into one. So the intervention becomes, if we don't do something about obesity, everyone's going to die. You know, it's all that kind of like the epidemic of obesity. Children are going to die before their grandparents. You know, all this, like, it scares the hell out of everyone. I am perfectly convinced that one of the reasons why younger people actually put on weight is because you make them so self-conscious about their bodies. The only time that I've really ever put on lots of weight was when I went to university, and in my first year, everyone was dieting. I'd never really thought about dieting before, and then I became obsessed with food, and I started eating more. And I actually got out of that, by the way, by starting to smoke. The irony of the whole thing.
Well, I was going to say that is a liberal. That is a liberal. That would encourage smoking.
So you get practical tips on this show.
Actually think that making young people even more obsessed with their body shape is not a plan. That is my general view. Right, let them get on. Mm-hmm. If a child is so overweight that they can't walk, there's probably an intervention required. But I mean, beyond that, and as for old people, as you say, get old disgracefully, and that might require putting on some weight.
And there's a question here about freedom of speech, which I'd like to pose to you, Claire, not only as a long-time campaigner for free speech, also a very, very good book called I Find That Offensive. So this is from Basil the Great. That's a Twitter handle. What do you think the best political party in the UK for freedom of speech is, and how do you see the fight for free speech going in the UK? And he's got a follow-up question here about what do you think about a kind of First Amendment style situation? Is that something that you'd support, or would it be something else?
Right. So very quickly, I mean, I do think that we're not going to get free speech by relying on any of the political parties that exist, and even some of the smaller embryonic up-and-coming parties like the SDP or what is it, Reform or Reclaim and all this. I mean, they're not always all consistent, but anyway, they're marginal in terms of their influence. In terms of the mainstream political parties, I wouldn't rely on them. And the reason why I'm slightly hesitating is because I've just come out of a debate on the Academic Freedom Bill, and I was just so horrified by the number of people who argued against that from opposition parties. On the basis that there's nothing to see here, exaggerated culture war, alt-right issue was the way that they posed it. You know, there's no problem of academic freedom, or there's a bit, but not really. And I ended up defending the Conservatives' Academic Freedom Bill, which I have some qualms about myself, right? Same with the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, which has been put forward by Dominic Raab, emphasises free speech as a foundational value, and everybody says, this Bill of Rights is going to destroy every single right we've ever had in this country, and how dare you put human rights versus free speech and free speech usurping hate speech. And by the time you finish, you end up thinking that the Conservative Party come over as the champions of free speech. And then you remember that they are bringing in the Online Safety Bill, which completely contradicts the Bill of Rights and their Academic Freedom Bill. And we kind of, to squeeze Steve Bray in here, the braying loudmouth remainer who is creates a nuisance of himself. Whenever I come out of Westminster Tube and he's there, he spots me, and it's humiliating because he's got this very loud sound system, and he goes, Claire Fox, Tory enabler. And you're right, so any embarrassed, and then you are responsible for, and he's like booming out, and then they follow me along, you know, they kind of like film me. And it's always, I mean, you know, I wanted the ground to seize up because it's more embarrassing, you know, when people are looking at you going, you somebody, and are you monster? And, oh, my God. And I still defend his right to do it, right? And I worry about the fact that the state has part of the policing bill brought in a kind of an attack on loud, noisy demonstrations and one-person demonstrations based on the fact they don't like Steve Bray shouting at them. And you do think this is like safe space for parliamentarians, you know what I mean? We don't want to be disturbed, you know what I mean?
It's Extinction Rebellion as well, isn't it?
No, the Extinction Rebellion, the Extinction Rebellion anti-protest stuff is yet to be passed.
Oh, really? That's different. Really,
that's different because
this is just a Steve Bray.
This was the noisy demonstration. I mean, I made the point, if you're trying to have a go at Extinction Rebellion on the basis of two noisy demonstrations, half the time they do it in silence and mime, right? I mean, that's not really our problem with them. Not that they make a noise, right? So it's just illiberalism. So back to the original question, free speech has been neglected, similar to what we said about abortion. We have to make the arguments for free speech each and every generation, each and every year. Don't ever take anything for granted. You can't just stand there with your J.S. Mill and go, there we go, on liberty, what's wrong with you lot? You illiberal. You've got to go out and win the arguments with young people, and they're different every time because now we know that safety and harm trumps liberty. And so it's up to us to start winning the arguments and never rely on a political party to do it, because they have absolutely lost any sense of liberty. But so far, the Conservatives at least pay lip service to it in some of their legislation. Just I don't trust them to mean it when I see the illiberal online safety bill, which is really scary.
And Chris, just finally, would you have a First Amendment if we could secure one?
Yeah, I'd love to have a First Amendment. Absolutely. And a second.
To defend the first. On that note, Chris, Claire, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.